Hello, it's Ari Rosenbaum here with an episode of that 401k podcast, and realized with a change in my software, the website, well, the program that I used to record the podcast with didn't work, even though it looked like it did. So apparently last week's episode was 30-something minutes of blank. So hopefully you can hear us. I see that the software is working, so I do apologize for the technical difficulties. I'm glad that we're still here. This week's episode is going to be called 10 Years In, a reflection of 10 years being in solo practice and my experiences at my old law firm and kind of the reason why I started on my own. But as always, first things first. Next week, Friday, May 8th, that 401k virtual conference 2, Electric Boogaloo, another virtual 401k conference. Find the links on LinkedIn, Twitter, sign in. It's free, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern. Great event, great plan providers. You learn something new every day. We'll talk about coronavirus and some of the other problems that, you know, everybody sees in this business. So please sign up. Also, in addition, hopefully we'll have some events this year. Every day that comes by, every day that passes, it looks more and more like the Minnesota event is going to have to be suspended as well. Hopefully we can have an event in December in Las Vegas, but, you know, as it's a very, very fluid, very, very fluid process, this whole pandemic. We learn something new every day, and what we thought we learned yesterday is no longer practical for today. And hopefully, sooner than later, life can return back to normal. Go to that 401ksite.com for further information. And of course, check in LinkedIn, my Twitter feed, Rosenbaum Law, for more information on how you could sign up for that 401k virtual conference too, Electric Boogaloo or Wrath of a Con or whatever sequel you want to talk about. And of course, unlike Caddyshack 2 and Smoking the Bandit Part 3 and Beyond the Poseidon Adventure, this is a sequel that's guaranteed not to suck. So please sign up today. And of course, like I said, this week's discussion is, you know, talk about 10 years being in my own practice. And, you know, as it's May the 1st, April, when I look back in my life, April was a very difficult month in my life. Problems at jobs during the month of April. And most importantly, my grandfather passed away in April when I was 7 years old. And it was always been a very, very difficult month for me. And I always like to get out of April unscathed. And it dawned on me a couple weeks ago that it was actually my 10th anniversary of starting my own practice. And looking back at some of the Facebook posts from 10 years earlier and really reflecting, it's kind of amazing that it's been 10 years. Sometimes it feels like last week, and, you know, of course, with the pandemic, everything just like a couple months ago feels like 20 years ago, and somehow sometimes the 10 years ago feels like 20 years ago. And when I started my own practice, when I came up with the idea of my own practice, I think that people, you know, family members and certainly people I knew in the business, mostly the law firm business rather than the retirement plan business, laughed at it. They thought it was a crazy idea. But I really had the determination that I was going to make a go of it. I had enough. You know, I had enough of working for others. I spent 9 years working for TPAs, and that was a great part of my career. And dealing with some of the plan administrative headaches and dealing with clients and charging them on a flat fee basis and really working well with other plan providers, I think that I had the necessary skill set in order to develop a very, very successful retirement plan practice. I learned from Rich Lareda, who I think was the greatest 401k salesperson I ever met. I had worked for Sheldon Geller, and I think that Sheldon Geller is one of the most talented people when it comes to sales. And you know, I think people may scoff at some of the other things that he's done or whatnot, but I think that he's been a very, very important, you know, contributor to my career, because a lot of things that he does, even today, that I really think is quite interesting and quite effective in getting clients and retaining them. So I think that I had the necessary skill set, and that's why I started my own. And I started my own 10 years ago because of the 2 years that I spent as an associate at Myers Watts English and Klein, which, you know, I think the first 10 years of my career and the last 10 years of my career have been very, very pleasant, great experiences overall. And those 2 years that I was at Myers Watts, it was probably the unhappiest 2 years of my career. And the reason is because back then I had the idea of starting a national ERISA practice at this law firm, Myers Watts English Klein, which I, over the years, I've jokingly called a semi-prestigious Long Island law firm. I thought I could develop a national practice. I worked out of their New York office, which at the time was their second biggest office, which I think now that they're down to like three attorneys over there, that maybe it's still their second biggest office, but that's a whole nother story. And I really thought that I had the skill set to develop a national ERISA practice. And I felt that with their you know, corporate practice in Long Island, that, you know, I could be very, very effective at cross-selling to our existing clients for their ERISA legal needs. And especially one thing I thought was working in my favor was the way partners would be compensated as part of their bonus is that they would get 50% of all the billings from their clients. So, for example, if a litigator got a client on a litigation matter, and then later they would cross-sell my services to that client, that ABC Corp, whatever it is, that litigator who has no ERISA experience whatsoever would still get 50 cents of every buck that I would bring into the firm for the existing client. To me, it was a win-win. To me, listen, if I was working at a law firm as a partner and I'd get 50 cents of every buck that another attorney generated for from another practice area, shoot, I think I'd invent practice areas that didn't exist to sell to my existing clients, just because it's like an annuity in the terms that it always pays out, and I got no traction from the existing lawyers. I think I got one client out of an existing law firm client. I can't explain it except for the fact that that law firm was made up of a lot of small law firms and sole proprietorships and whatnot. And, you know, for some reason, they acted like some sort of fiefdom within this larger law firm setting, and they didn't want me to interact with their clients no matter what I would do, no matter how many networking meetings I did and bringing them out to a free lunch with some advisor who thought they could generate some business with the firm. You know, I really tried to develop relationships. You know, I gave away U.S. Open tickets at Bethpage Black to some of the partners, and it went absolutely nowhere. And, you know, I think that's why, you know, if you read my writings and books and I talk about the experience, it's a very, very bitter experience to me, because, you know, it's one of the few times in my life where I gave so much and it was never, you know, I worked so hard and tried to develop a relationship with the law firm partners, and it was just I was like dog crap to them. I never mattered. And, you know, to me, it's like when you're really, really interested in a girl in high school or college, and you're really, really trying to work hard and you're doing everything right, and for some reason she doesn't care for you, it hurts. The truth hurts. And I you know, when I was there, my wife said to me, "Oh, you know, Ari, they really don't care about you. You try so hard." And, you know, and one thing I adore my wife, but I always say the one thing that's the biggest thing I can't stand about my wife is that she's usually right about these things. And, you know, the several situations in my life where she would say, you know what, you're not getting it from the other side. You're giving so much of yourself, and she's right. And I hate it when she's right. And I think that over the last few years, I've tried to avoid that kind of situation. And I think the last time that happened was about 3-4 years ago with the synagogue that I was very, very involved with, where, you know, I gave so much of myself and raised so much money and ran events. And it was clear that the people at the synagogue just didn't care about me. I didn't mean anything to them. And it's disappointing. It hurts. And, you know, I'm the type of person who walks with that hurt, because that hurt, that bitterness, you know, fuels what I do. It's still to this day. I mean, it's 10 years ago. I'm sure most people would say, God, you know, Ari, just get past this. And I can't get past it because, you know, I think that, you know, inspires me to work hard and develop relationships and come up with new ideas for how to, you know, generate interest in my legal services. And, you know, and I guess in my own practice, I'm doing it the right way, doing what I thought I could have done at Meyer Suozzi that I just couldn't. And so while I couldn't get anywhere with the law firm partners, I realized that, you know, still, if I wanted to be employed over there, I still had to generate business. And one of the ways I thought I could generate business was to write articles for plan providers to use to get clients. And, you know, when the risks and legal needs of their clients were known, these advisors or TPAs could refer me in. And that's what I thought I could do. And the reason I did that was I knew a financial advisor who, when I told them my practice of working with the clients and charging a flat fee and keeping them out of fiduciary harm's way and all that kind of stuff, the advisor said, well, what's in it for me? So I said, nothing. Didn't get a client from that advisor. But anyway, it led me to develop the idea that, you know, maybe if I develop marketing materials for these plan providers that they could use in getting clients or keeping existing clients, that's a way to drum up business and drum up in my reputation. And, you know, going back to that 401k conference in Los Angeles at Dodger Stadium, one of the nicest things that was ever said to me was by J.D. Carlson, when he took out one of the payroll provider TPA articles I'd written and said, you know, thanks to Ari, you know, we have this article and I've used this article to generate business as well as to warn my existing clients of not to go to, you know, the ADP and Paychex of the world and utilize them for its 401k TPA. And that was a perfect example of what these articles are all about. So it made sense. We had a great marketing department. I'd write an article and, you know, maybe the lawyers, the firm would distribute it and, you know, get somewhere. And the problem with the marketing department was it was only a handful of people. And, you know, they worked with 60-some-odd attorneys. And most importantly, when I would write an article, it would have to go through three different levels of partners. You had the advertising committee, which comprised of one associate who didn't generate any business and who said I couldn't use social media because that was some sort of legal advertising. Then it would have to go through the ERISA partner, who probably couldn't spell 401k if I spotted her the 4, the O, the 1, and the K, because she was a union ERISA lawyer. And then it was the managing committee would have to approve it. So for one article in particular, it took 6 months to get it approved and published. And after it was published, out of 30-some-odd partners, only one partner actually generated and sent it out to their existing clients. And again, the problem with the marketing department was, again, so many partners were sending them, you know, stuff that needed to be worked on. But the law firm administrator, Fred, who, if you ever read my articles, you know all about Fred. And Fred would have the marketing department publish his articles on law firm administration, which to me, I thought was unprofessional because, you know, we were a law firm in the, you know, business of providing legal services. We were not in the business of providing legal administration or administration of law firms. And to me, I didn't find it different than, you know, some law firm partner asking the marketing department to work on his, you know, kid's, you know, little league team. And the funny side note about Fred was, after I left Myers Swazi, I wrote some articles just mocking what he did. And that was the end of his, he never published another article ever again as long as he was at that firm. So, I think I had something to do with it. But anyway, I really, you know, couldn't generate any business. And, you know, Lois, the managing attorney, always looked down on me. I always say in my life, you know, there are people who don't like me, and I'll be honest, and I'll say that I've usually given these people a reason to not like me, and Lois was the person who, you know, I one of the few people in my life where I just didn't like me from day one. I don't know what I did. I've said recently, I felt like, you know, she didn't like me. I was a tough Jew from Brooklyn. And, you know, she wanted some Ivy League, I don't know, WASP or something. I don't know. It was just, I always allude to the movie Caddyshack, and somehow Lois was Judge L. Hugh Smales, and I was Al Chervik, the Rodney Dangerfield character, because she had just nothing but contempt for me. I don't know what I did. Listen, I'm a kid from Brooklyn. I always come up with ideas. Some of them are good. Some of them really suck. But the fact of the matter is that she just thought that anything I did was beneath, you know, what she had in mind that the law firm should be. And I think that's the problem of the mid-sized law firm. They think too much that they are a large-sized law firm. They have the high overhead. They have the fancy offices. They have the unnecessary people in in law firm administration. And the problem with the mid-sized law firm is that they don't have the clientele with the pocketbooks or the wallets that a large law firm has. You know, when you have, you know, ExxonMobil or Microsoft or really these big publicly traded companies as your as clients, obviously they have the bankroll to pay your bills. And when you're a mid-sized law firm, you don't have that clientele. And, you know, and many of the people from the mid-sized law firms are refugees from larger firms, and they don't understand that, you know, the large firm market is quite different from the mid-sized market. And I've always said I think the mid-sized law firm is one of the worst-run businesses, almost as bad as airlines. But, you know, it was really a really a bitter experience, and of course that always brings up, I think, the I always talk about the experience where I always felt the most insulted. I think that one part of my belief is that we let the experts decide things. You know, when I go to a doctor, I ask the doctor for advice and I listen to what the doctor says. I listen to what the doctor says. I just don't tune them out and then just do something, you know, other. I let the experts handle it. Same thing with, you know, anything else. You know, I have a great car mechanic, Ralph. I let Ralph dictate, you know, when I need to change my brakes or when I need a oil change. I don't take Ralph's advice and then ignore it. You've got to take the expert's advice. And so Myers Swazi had a 401k plan. And, you know, the HR director just asked me for my help. I gave her my 2 cents and recommendations, and of course she didn't follow it. And I just I just felt very insulted, especially because she mismanaged the law firm's 401k plan. And, you know, what's the point of asking me for my advice if you're just going to ignore it? You know, it was a very, very bitter experience, and I kind of knew the axe was eventually going to come, and I decided, you know, 2 or 3 months before that I felt like it was going to go a certain way, I said, you know what, if I'm going to leave, I'm going to start my own practice. I didn't tell my wife that, but I decided on my own that I had enough. This wasn't working out for me anymore, and if I went to another firm, I'd get the same kind of crap. And I just can't deal with it. But before I left, I did talk to another law firm, and I always tell this funny story where they asked me, "Well, Ari, how much you make?" I said, "Yeah, $150,000." And this new law firm said, "Oh, well, for you to get paid $150,000, you have to bring in $400,000 worth of business." And I said to myself, if I could bring in $400,000 worth of business, why the hell do I need you? When I started my own practice, I decided, I looked to what other firms did. I looked to what Myers-Swazi did and what I didn't like. I didn't like the billable hour. I wanted to start my own practice with a flat fee basis. I wanted to network. I wanted to use social media. I wanted to write articles. And I wanted to be me, and I wanted to be free. And one of my favorite movies of all time is The Shawshank Redemption. And there are two times in my life where I felt like I was Andy Dufresne. One time was in law school, and the other time was working for Myers-Swazi, where I felt like I was in some sort of prison. And sometimes prison doesn't have to be an actual prison. Sometimes prison can just be, being chained and bonded. Something that you don't want to be a part of. And I realized that, some lawyers can't be law firm associates. Some birds aren't meant to be caged. And the best way for me was to move on and start my own practice and chart my own fate and not let my fate be decided by a bunch of lawyers who still thought it was, instead of 2010, they still thought it was 1990 in the ways of getting business. I knew that Myers-Swazi was going to suffer over the next few years because they had no social media presence. They didn't understand that the business and getting clients was changing, and they didn't want to change from the times. There's just, you had a managing attorney who was stuck in the past, was really arrogant, just thought she knew everything. When I brought up social media, she says, "Oh yeah, my husband does that. He's an attorney," and she looked down on it. And, obviously the best situation for me was to move on from someplace like that. But, like I said, I still have that chip on my shoulder. There's nothing worse, than to fail. And there's nothing worse than to fail when you had no control. If you fail on your own, and you make mistakes and you screw up, it's on you. And there's nobody else to blame. And, ultimately, the failure at Myers-Swazi English Klein falls on me. I didn't generate the business I thought I could generate. The fact that I was, handcuffed, it is what it is. And, that failure, I took my greatest failure and turned it into what I think is some sort of success. But the beauty of it is, especially now with the pandemic and I can wake up anytime I want and not have to worry, about some partner's meeting or just this and that. And I don't need to have permission in order to launch another virtual conference or plan sponsor forum or whatever else I may come up with. And that's great because freedom from some people in business, it's the greatest thing, and there are quite a few other people can't do it, and there's nothing wrong with it if you can't survive on your own, but for somebody like me who is too arrogant to think that all he did was no better than anybody else, it was the perfect opportunity for me, and, listen, there's a reason people listen to me, there's people read my articles, and I'm just grateful to be part of this, retirement plan industry, and grateful that I can have an unfettered access to the tools that could generate me a pretty decent-sized audience. So I'm glad that you, stuck around for the 20-some-odd minutes of me babbling on and on about something that happened 10 years ago. But, I hope you can learn something from it. Maybe have some empathy. Maybe you've had a similar experience in the past and realize that, just because somebody says somebody looks down on you doesn't mean that, they're right. As long as you believe in yourself, as long as you have confidence in your abilities, and as long as you have the training to be successful, then, you know, I think that it's very hard to keep talent down. And I've seen that. I've worked at places where, you know, talent was held down, and then, you know, these people went on their own and started their own practice or started their own business and became way successful. I worked for a TPA, and if I would tell you the people that were involved in that business who were pushed aside one for one reason or another, you look at probably, you know, an all-star lineup of what a TPA should be. But that's, you know, that's human nature. You know, not everybody gets what's coming to them. Not everybody, the best person doesn't always get the job. And but I think the most important thing to realize is that you can't keep good talent down. Talent always will find a way out. It may not be at the firm that they're at now. It may be at the next firm or whatever it is. But I think the most important thing to realize, and look at my experience, is you can't keep good talent down. Good talent will eventually rise up. So I hope you enjoyed that 401k podcast. Hopefully from now on we'll have audio for you to actually listen to this event, to this podcast. And of course, go to that401ksite.com for further information on all my events. Thanks and take care.